Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and today in Focus on Africa, the Rwandan government says the July elections will be free and fair.
We have chosen the kind of politics that fits our context, that brings Rwandans together, that prioritizes unity, that brings back the value, the dignity of human life in Rwanda.
But can the opposition face off President Kagame? Also, a look at aid cheating in sports and why football federations in Africa need to address the problem.
The reason why we have this problem is that records keeping are poor. Most of the coaches who are also managing these players are desperate for podium success when they take these youth players out because they want to win at all costs. That is why they will bring a player who is also desperate.
And a young Sierra Leonean is banking on a robot to preach peace in a country still reeling from the effects of war.
So I purposely designed this robot. Since we humans don't want to accept peace within ourselves, I think if this robot comes in, it will sound very interesting and mind-blowing.
It's Friday, the 15th of March. Visitors to Rwanda are often blown away to find a country where things seem to work efficiently. It's neat and tidy with lush green views, and the Wi-Fi is good in the capital, Kigali. Everyone tends to pay their taxes, services are reliable, the roads are safe. In fact, the government calls it one of the world's safest nations. However, Human Rights Watch says the space for political opposition, civil society and media remain closed, and the country's ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, target those perceived as a threat to the government and their family members. Several opposition members and commentators are missing or have been arrested. For more, I've been speaking to the Rwandan government spokesperson, Yolande Makolo. Rwandans go to the polls on July the 15th to elect the president and members of the Chamber of Deputies. I wonder how things are shaping up. How are things looking like?
Things are looking good. It's a busy year for Rwanda. We not only have elections in July, but in a few weeks, we'll be commemorating 30 years since the genocide against the Tutsi on April 7th. And then we also have a Liberation Day in July. That's the day that the genocide was stopped. So it's a milestone year for Rwanda.
And you've mentioned about the genocide, and of course, this year being 30 years since the unfortunate event of 1994, I wonder how that history has shaped the country's understanding of democracy.
The genocide changed everything for Rwanda. Over a million people were killed because of who they were, by their fellow Rwandans. So it changed everything for us, everything, not just democracy, our understanding of politics, what it means to live together, relationships in the region with countries farther afield, because this genocide also involved powerful countries in various ways. We hit rock bottom, but at the same time, we managed to pull ourselves together afterwards. So Rwanda today is better off than it's ever been in its entire history.
I mean, it's a remarkable story in terms of the turnaround, because I've had the occasion of reporting out of Rwanda in 2010, covering the elections there. And what I got from that experience is that many things that are done in Rwanda are largely influenced by its history. So then how does the country really avoid becoming hostage to its past when it comes to issues such as democracy, which you've mentioned, its politics and the freedom of expression?
We have chosen the kind of politics that fits our context, that brings Rwandans together, that prioritizes unity, that brings back the value, the dignity of human life in Rwanda. And as a government, our job is to ensure that Rwandans have conducive environment to exercise their rights and to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities that we're building here.
And so talking about people exercising their rights, and one of it is people deciding how they would like to be governed. So I just want to reference this year's election. And there's been a certain perception that there's no real opposition in the country, and this has blocked, you know, the margins of a vibrant opposition that could provide checks and balances across institutions in Rwanda. So, Yolande, what do you say to that?
The job of RPF is not to build opposition. The job of RPF is to deliver to Rwandans. And RPF has done a remarkable job in delivering to Rwandans. And if we get a large percentage of the vote, this is the reason. The RPF is a party that was responsible for stopping the genocide and saving lives and ensuring that there was no revenge on the perpetrators of genocide. We worked together with Rwandans to build this country back and ensure that Rwandans were able to put together a constitution that fits our context. So this is Rwandan democracy in action. It's the democracy that fits our context. Anyone with viable other ways in which other forms of governance delivers to Rwandans is welcome to present themselves and let Rwandans choose. That's what democracy is about.
And just talking about viability, because, you know, largely there's been that criticism about a closed political space. And I'm just going to read from Human Rights Watch, and this is a report. They say the ruling RPF continued to stifle dissenting and critical voices and to target those perceived as a threat to the government and their family members. The space for political opposition, civil society and media remain closed. What's your response to those allegations?
Why should Human Rights Watch be relevant to Rwanda? They're an NGO. Who are they accountable to? Who is Human Rights Watch accountable to? And do they have a monopoly on human rights? Rwanda belongs to Rwandans.
Let me just add on to something else that's come out from the latest Press Freedom Index. The country features as one of the poorest in Africa in terms of liberties when it comes to the media landscape. And so there's currently an international campaign being pushed for the release of Neon Senga, also known as Siuma Hassan. So what do you have to say this? Because then that's not a coincidence.
What I have to say about media in Rwanda is that it has developed over the years. We're not where we were 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. Now we have over 20 TV stations. We have close to 40 radio stations, most of them private. So what these organizations are talking about do not consider these facts and how things are changing on the ground.
I'm wondering, really, for those that have been incarcerated on various charges, because how this is being perceived outside is that really the government is, you know, positioning itself and saying, okay, yeah, Rwanda is open for business. You can come here, enjoy civil liberties. But the realities on the ground is, you know, suggesting the contrary.
It's not suggesting the contrary. You're throwing one person at us who's in prison for charges that have nothing to do with journalism. Journalists are people. And if he violated the laws that govern all of us, he's liable to that.
All right, so let's talk about something that's been in the news and it's really been of interest, and that's Victor Umuhoza Ingabire, who was recently disqualified from contesting the presidency in the upcoming elections. What do you say to people who have suggestions that she should have been allowed to contest in consideration of inclusivity and also just as a sign of opening up the political space and participation in Rwanda?
We were very pleased that the court upheld the rule of law by refusing even to examine her request to be rehabilitated, because the law says that if you're convicted of a crime that has you sentenced for more than 6 months, you cannot run for office. And these kind of laws exist everywhere. It's about the safety of Rwandans. It's about all of us abiding by the law. When you're talking specifically about Victoire Ingabire, she's a convicted criminal whose sentence was commuted by presidential pardon. The crimes of which she was convicted are serious crimes.
And so finally, Yolande, the President Kagame has been nominated to run for a fourth time. And I remember, you know, following the joint press conference that he had with Kenyan President William Ruto. And what he said is that we've been in this discussion since 2010, but circumstances, challenges and history of Rwanda tend to dictate certain things. The question lingering in the minds of so many people is, what circumstances make it impossible, possibly for anyone else, to lead Rwanda?
Well, the first circumstances is Rwandans want him to continue. His party want him to continue as the flag bearer, overwhelmingly so. We're very conscious that we have to build an environment where other leaders emerge and that they can also show up and take up this burden of leading this very beautiful and complicated country with so much work to do. So the party is very conscious of that. And when the president decides that he no longer wants to run for office or he's no longer able to, then we know that we've done our work to build a new generation of leaders that can take over.
This is, however, one side of the story. So how do the opposition perceive what's happening politically in Rwanda? Let's find out more from the opposition leader, Dr. Frank Habineza. In 2017, Dr. Habineza, you only managed to secure 0.4% of the vote. Why are you so determined to try again? What are your chances?
I'm trying again because I believe that democracy is a process. I believe that democracy is not a one-day thing. And I've seen my colleagues from Uganda, from Kenya, like Raila Odinga, they've tried even more than 2, 3, 4 times, and they've made a big, significant change in Kenya. So I believe that this is a process, but I've also seen successes elsewhere. In Zambia, the opposition have tried and they have won seats, the presidency. We've seen that happening in Senegal. So I believe that this is a continuous process. It's tough, it's hard, but it's worth trying because what we believe in, finally, everybody comes to our conclusion that we are right because we believe in change and peaceful change and cannot get peaceful change if you don't go to elections because we don't believe in war.
It's interesting because in Rwanda right now, majority of the opposition parties back the ruling Rwanda Patriotic Front, and you seem to be sort of like a lone ranger. I wonder what it's like really playing opposition politics in an environment that is largely dominated by the ruling party, which has got a couple of parties that have coalesced around it.
It's tough. It's tough indeed. You know, this was the most difficult change we had in 2017 because it was only our party against a 90-party coalition. So like all parties were together. That's, you can say, the whole country. We were against the whole country. That's what I could say. It was the whole government structure, the whole state structure, apparatus, all parties, the whole ordinary government with all key positions. But we managed to get a lot of support from the people, to get our voice heard. And people understood us more, and they understood what we stand for. And you know what happened? That a year later, when we stood for parliamentary elections, we were able to get 5% of the national vote, which was a big percentage. From the 0.4 we had in the previous year, we were able to jump to 5%, and we got seats in parliament. Now we have 2 seats in parliament and 1 seat in the Senate. So this was a big improvement. So I do believe that it's not easy, but it's possible because we have proved it that we can make a change.
So you've got 2 members of parliament. I wonder how you're able to push legislative agenda, because really, you're a literal minority.
The fun part of being a member of parliament in Rwanda is that when you get elected, you get elected as a party or representing women or youth, or those are the main blocks that bring people to parliament. So in Rwanda, we do not have constituencies. So when you are MP or a national MP, whereby you have a chance to be in any place in the country and represent those people. But not only we as a political party, an opposition party, we don't use only parliament. We also use other channels like the media. We are very frequently interacting with the media. We give different interviews to the local media. And our members, they are very active members. Of recent, we also had local elections where some of our members got elected into local structures. We have some in the district councils, others in other local councils. So we make sure that wherever we are, we take the opportunity to issue our voice, to make sure that we make a statement and the voice goes far. It's not that we are few. We are few in number, but we are big in idea.
So Rwanda has made a significant turnaround, major milestones economically and socially. But then we're having, you know, criticism coming from rights bodies who say that people who live in that country struggle to really exercise their fundamental rights and freedoms. What's your view on this, and what's the reality?
The reality is that as a party, we have our main focus, number one priority, is fighting for freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and freedom of the media. We believe that these things are still lacking in Rwanda, and we are the ones who are going to help to bring this into Rwanda. People still have a fear of expressing their opinions. The journalists, they still have challenges. Even now, the biggest challenge with the media is the issue of financing, because private media lacks advertisements from the state institutions. So you find that most of the some state private media radios or TVs, some of them have closed down. So people prefer to be in the state media or state-related media because there they have more opportunities. So you find that if we continue like this, then even the opposition will be weak, because for the opposition to be strong, there has to be also a strong media, and people have to be free to expressing themselves. So it's a challenge. People should be feeling free to join any political party. We still have challenges. People prefer to be in the ruling coalition because it's easier for them to get jobs. Because some of us who are in the opposition, it's very difficult to find jobs. Because if you understand that you're from the Green Party, it can be difficult to get a job. But women, I believe that it will change, and it's changing little by little, but it's a struggle, continuous struggle.
And talking about this struggle, because one of the big stories that has been out in the media and a lot of people have been following has been the attempt by Victoire Ingabire to contest for the presidency. We know that the court made a decision and she was disqualified on the grounds that, you know, she'd been previously convicted. As an opposition leader in Rwanda, what's your take on that?
Well, nobody, I'm a lawyer, I don't like to talk about issues which have been decided by courts of laws. So I prefer to jump that question.
Would you be open to joining forces perhaps with Ingabire in your party, maybe in the run-up to the elections, some sort of like, you know, coalition? I know that a party has not been officially or legally registered.
As you know, my party worked with her, with Ingabire's party in 2010. So we had like coalition, we call it Consultative Forum of Opposition Parties in Rwanda. It was her party and Pierre Simbarakuri, Bernard Ntaganda's faction. So we had an agreement, a memorandum which we signed together to work together to enforce democracy in Rwanda. She phoned us in Rwanda when we had started the party when she came from the Netherlands. Things went the other way around, whereby she was put in prison and my vice president, Andre Kagari Sereka, was assassinated in 2010. I had to escape the country. I went to exile in Sweden. The colleague, Bernard Ntaganda, was put in prison. It took a lot of efforts and with a lot of support from the international community for me to come back 2 years later in 2012 to reestablish the party again. She was still in prison. Bernard was still in prison. I finally got registered in 2013 after several efforts. So it took us 4 years. So it's quite a difficult decision. Now we decided to disband the coalition as it was no longer existing because the colleagues were in prison. When she got out, as one of the first people went to visit her to her home, because I was very happy that she was out of prison when she got her presidential pardon. For now, she has no political party, which is registered. So our party is a registered political party. So as you understand, the registered political party cannot cooperate with an unregistered party.
Rwandan opposition leader, Dr. Frank Habineza. Should age just be a number? And should cheating about your age ruin your career? Well, recently, dozens of Cameroonian national footballers have been suspended from the domestic league by FICAFOOT, that's the Cameroonian Football Federation, for allegedly falsifying their age. At least 62 players are accused of the offence, including celebrated midfielder Wilfried Nathan Douala, who shocked AFCON by claiming to be 17 years old. There have been numerous instances of people fabricating their age in various sports such as athletics. So why the uproar? To find out more, I spoke with the BBC Africa sport journalist, Oluwaseuna Okeleji. First things first, what is age cheating?
Age cheating, or age fraud, as it's popularly known, is a situation whereby a person claims to be younger than they really are. So in this instance, we've had players who play in under 17U tournament when they are actually over the age, meaning they are like 25 or above. So they have to change their identity to be able to be younger, to play in a competition meant for genuinely under 17 players. So when you have a 25-year-old playing in an under 17 tournament, it's clearly committed age fraud and it's done age cheating.
I'm just curious then, how do you determine a player's age? How does the testing work?
So the problem is, under 17 tournament is the cadet tournament in world football, FIFA's major tournament in the world. So when you look at this tournament, Africa are the most successful continent in this tournament. Nigeria have 5 titles and I think Ghana have 3. So telling you that undoubtedly Nigeria are the most successful side. But every time Africa play in this under 17 tournament, allegations of age cheating always becloud their success. Teams from South America, Europe. So in 2009, FIFA then created, they started the MRI scan. The MRI scan, which is magnetic resonance imaging, which allows players to be tested on the wrist, examining the growth plates before grading it from 1 to 6. So grade 6 means the player's growth plate has completely fused to the bone, which typically happens around the age of 18 or 19. So FIFA introduced this in 2009. However, FIFA and CAF since come out to say, look, it cannot determine the exact age of these players. But it tells you that, Chief, please, if you are grade 6, you are not eligible to play in an under-17 tournament. You are above that age. But say a player from Nigeria comes and play in the under-20, he does not have to undergo this testing. It can only be done in the cadet under-17. It opens up for debate why a lot of people would say, oh, if you escape from the under-17, then you cannot be caught when you go to the under-20s tournament.
So why is the spotlight on Wilfried Duala? And why are we suddenly discovering this now?
It's a shame because Duala was celebrated just 2 months ago in the Ivory Coast during the African Cup of Nations as the youngest player to come and represent any nation at a tournament. He was supposedly 17. When his picture was shared on social media, there was uproar and outcry in Cameroon that this young man here doesn't look 17. But no one can determine that. So, you know, he went to the tournament. And because he went to that tournament, even though he did not appear for Cameroon in that tournament, the fact that his name came out from the 62 suspended players has finally raised the eyebrows and, of course, concerns in Cameroon. Because should Cameroon be found guilty that this player lied about his age, they could be suspended from future African Cup of Nations tournaments. Because even though he did not play, he was registered. CAF rules state clearly that if there's a fraud committed in terms of registration and whatnot, that country will be suspended from future tournaments. So that is why Duala is making the headlines in Cameroon and across Africa as not actually being 17, because according to records in Cameroon, his old age means he should be 22 now and not 17. So how can you be younger when you're supposed to be older?
The administrative body now, which is the Cameroonian Football Federation, it all squarely lies on their shoulders. I don't know what they're saying about this. Has there been any official statement to this development?
No, FECAFOOT have refused to comment. CAF are yet to comment as well. So for FECAFOOT, they said they will carry out their investigation and whatever it is, they will make it known. But his club in Cameroon, Victoria United, have since come out with a statement saying the player is genuinely a 17-year-old player. And their fans should calm down because they are in the right and they have not committed any age fraud. That's the latest information. But no word has come in from Cameroon governing body, FECAFOOT, as yet.
This has really come in as a shock. And of course, it's frustrating and disappointing. What's really been the reaction from their fans?
I think generally people in Cameroon are not shocked or surprised. They are only worried about the timing of this news now. A lot of people said this is not true. It can't be 17. But it's nothing new in Cameroon. Over the years, clubs in Cameroon tend to submit protests or apply for boardroom points toward the end of the season, citing the ineligibility of certain players. So, but when Samuel Eto'o came, that's the former captain of Cameroon, took over as president of the Federation in 2021, he says he wants to combat age fraud. And that's why we are getting this all the time. And this is not the first time in Cameroon that we are hearing this. What the fans are now saying is maybe Cameroon needs to actually face the full wrath of the law and learn from this sort of embarrassment so that Cameroon football can be clean from top to bottom.
And is this just a Cameroonian problem or have there been other cases across the continent? Remember even back in the days when we had Julius Agahoa, you know, the likes facing similar allegations, but that's an era gone by. But I don't know whether that's prevalent still in the continent.
Well, it is not just a Cameroon problem, but a sub-Saharan African one, because issues of age fraud, like I said, has led to the suspension of Ghana, Nigeria, Gambia, DR Congo, Tanzania, and over 10 countries. So it's a general problem in Africa. And the reason why we have this problem is that records keeping are poor. Most of the coaches who are also managing these players are desperate for podium success when they take these youth players out because they want to win at all costs. That is why they will bring a player who is also desperate to get a career in Europe, becoming a 17-year-old when they're actually 25-year-old or more or older than that. So it's a general problem in Africa that needs a deeper look and, of course, cleansing.
I know this incident, as you're suggesting, provides an opportunity for a lot of introspection, especially for players within the football sector across the continent. I wonder, what's African football doing then to address this problem?
CAF is the governing body in Africa, and the least they can do is to suspend countries from participating and, of course, fine countries. And I think when this is done regularly, when a country is suspended, the next batch of talent that are supposed to come through will not get an opportunity to play in international competition. So that, for me, is an opportunity for those countries to look inwards and fix the problem. Each time any African player comes to Europe, the first question they ask them is, are you truly your age? Tell us the truth. because they no longer believe the passport, which generally across the globe should be something to truly ascertain that a player who says he's 17 is 17. But across Europe, it's been raising question mark and, of course, affecting players from getting their opportunities to go, not just to Europe, Asia, or any other place where they can take their professional career to. So I think Africa needs to fix Africa. Africa needs to fix the continent. Africa needs to fix the football for all of these problems to go away.
Thank you so much for that perspective. Great having you on the program once again.
Thanks for having me.
The BBC's Oluwaseuna Okeleji. And now to Sierra Leone, where a young innovator has designed what he believes is a robot that can preach peace to a country that has experienced the trauma of war, and where even though the country is at peace, various political players find it difficult to trust each other. Ibrahim Danke, a young innovator, says he created the first robot that can play a role in bringing peace and harmony between opposing parties. Ibrahim says the usually loud and extremely rowdy political campaigns tend to create divisions rather than bring people together, and a robot telling everyone about the need for peace will attract all sides in Sierra Leonean politics. He's been speaking to my colleague Audrey Brown on why he decided to create such a robot.
People are scared of talking to each other about the same message of peace. When you do that, you don't have a very encouraging way to do that. They'll be thinking of you being in government of the day or you being at the opposition party, one of the two. Normally, without this misunderstanding, when coming to these political parties, people normally use these trucks, big trucks, heavy speaker, walking around people to disseminate whatever message on peace. And I was thinking it was not suitable enough for them to receive the message. It was that kind of noisy. So when I think of these two challenges, for me to design a robot that will be there, whether we are fans of the government of the day, you are fans of the opposition party, but to the fact that you seeing this out there disseminating the message of peace, I believe it will get your mind blown. You will take the hatred or whatever and put it aside and decide to admire it and thinking of Sierra Leone to another level.
So essentially you're saying that when people talk about peace to each other, there's the possibility that they'll think that this one supports that politician
exactly.
or the other politician.
Exactly.
So they don't trust
exactly.
each other. But they trust
exactly.
a robot.
Sure.
So the robot looks like a robot, as far as I'm concerned. But you describe it for us. And how did you go about putting it together?
There are two in number. The one at the front is the one pedaling the bicycle. But the one at the front have no tendency to interact with women. Its duties was to just ride into whatever destination of our choice.
So there's more than one?
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. two of them. The one at the front will be doing the pedaling. It's pedaling the bicycle.
Okay.
It will be riding the one that is sitting at the back. It has all the features that the normal human being has when riding a bicycle. It can move the bicycle front, back, left, and right.
Right.
To whatever destination.
Yeah, I've seen images of it doing that. So let me talk to the Dane bots.
Okay.
Hello, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Dane Kebot. I am made in Sierra Leone, West Africa.
You sound almost American, Dane Kebot. Are you?
I'm not.
Right, you are from Sierra Leone. What do you do, Dane Kebot?
I'm made to preach peace.
You preach peace. Why do you want to preach peace? Why do you preach peace, Dane Kebot?
Because peace is the answer to our existence.
Do people listen to you when you preach peace, Dane Kebot?
Do sometimes.
And when they don't listen to you, what do you think? What do you do to make them listen to you?
Use my programming language to convince them.
Okay. Let's look at a couple of facts. What's the capital of Sierra Leone? Do you know?
Freetown.
And can you tell me why there was war in Sierra Leone?
Because people did not listen to each other.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dane Kebot. Ibrahim, let me talk to the human again. What made you decide on the robot? And how did you get the skills to do this? Because it's a very skilled, very highly skilled thing that you have to do to create a robot, no?
I believe I can give gratitude to God Almighty for giving me short and innovative mindset. Because without that, I don't think you can delve into anything when it comes to innovation. So I've been having this curiosity when it comes to science and technology and see how I could get things done since childhood, starting up till now. So I purposely designed this robot. Since we humans don't want to accept peace within ourselves, I think if this robot comes in, it will sound very interesting and mind-blowing. It will get them a whole distraction and get their attention. And indeed, they did it whenever we went on the street to disseminating this message. So come and see, how possible is this? If the robot finally got their attention, there is a high tendency for them to accept the message of peace. Okay. And indeed, they were so happy.
So where did you learn the skills? How did you go to university to study engineering or robotics or coding or any of those things?
No, ma'am. It was one of my dreams to one day go into the university and enhance this innovative critical thinking into electrical electronic and specializing on biomedical engineering at my own dream university when God created the time for me. But I have never set my foot in the university yet.
Break down the component parts of DenkiBot for me.
All of the body was made out of this thin metal plate. It's what I used to do its structure, its whole body, and some basic electrical wiring. And above all, using the Arduino components to do its major robotics on it. Most of the components were from this junkyard.
It's like scrap metal that you're using.
Exactly. The one that has been talking, do the human interaction with you right now, is the one that is sitting at the back. He will be doing the talking. It can stand and sit down. When talking, its mouth can flip like a normal human being. So the process of being it standing, there is this a motto that when you give it a power, it can turn clockwise and anti-clockwise. So I got these mottos from these scrap vehicles.
How long did it take you to actually find the materials, going through the junkyard, seeing whether this works or that works or not? How long did you take to build the robot?
It took me a whole lot of time. I can say 1 year precisely.
Oh, that's not a lot. I thought it would have taken you much longer. You must have a very creative brain.
Thank you, ma'am.
Audrey Brown, talking to Ibrahim Damke. Thanks for listening to this episode of Focus on Africa. It was produced by Daniel Dadzi, Stefania Okereke, and Victor Silva in London. Sunita Nahar was in charge, and the technical producer was Jonathan Greer. Andre Lombard and Alice Modengi are the editors. Remember to download our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one new story shaping the continent. Find it on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kagoy. Have a lovely weekend.
Hi, I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're the hosts of a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Where to Be a Woman. So, what's the podcast about, Saatchi?
It's all about where in the world women are living their best lives, what female wellness looks like globally, and what the rest of us may be able to learn from it.
And where can people find it?
Just search for Where to Be a Woman wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.